Alrighty, welcome back to another episode of the Lookout Podcast, special Christmas episode, because today is Christmas Day. Merry Christmas to everybody.
Merry Christmas, one and all.
I'm joined by my older brother, Caleb Barrett, for our annual holiday Christmas podcast. Thanks for coming, man. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me on again. I like it. I like this tradition we're starting here.
Yeah, it's great, man. Usually we try to do it a few days before, but with that cold going around and then just all the festivities coming up to Christmas. It was a little busier this year.
Tis the season.
Tis the season, right.
You've got one more on the ground, so.
Yeah, man. Yeah, I think it's Bronson was saying, like, one is a lot, one is one, but then two might as well be a million. kind of feel that.
You're not prepared.
Yeah, two is definitely an upgrade to responsibilities. Oh, getting her going. I haven't even loaded mine up yet.
Oh, yeah.
This is my annual pipe smoking, too, because I haven't touched this sucker since our last episode.
Perfect.
Yeah.
It's well-seasoned.
Well-seasoned.
Ready to go.
Yeah, one time. One-time use. But I also wanted to talk about with the holiday spirit here, you know, the... We talked about it a little bit last time. Last year was with the peanuts and the, Charlie Brown's issue with trying to figure out what Christmas really is about. And then, his lines explain it and the true meaning of Christmas. I think people still kind of struggle with that. Like, get on Instagram and folks are talking about, like, you know, don't leave religion out of Christmas. And other people, like, would probably rather not have it in there. And it's just like, I think we just need to go back to the basics of Christmas, which was just like gathering, bringing people together, especially in a dark time of the year.
Right. Yeah, I think we touched on that last year, and there's several tribes of people, several cultures used the winter for a time to gather, share food, share shelter, and lodging. And then at the same time, because you're bringing all those people together, well, they didn't have TV or magazines, newspaper, hardly even books. Not too long ago, people weren't even literate, so there was storytelling, and there was gathering, and there was time to come together. You know, and everybody's reason for the season is different. This is the holiday season for many different cultures, many religions, and I think you also needed to remain true to that, too, whether you're celebrating Christmas or Hanukkah or Kwanzaa or whatever George Costanza's dad was all about, Festivus for the rest of us.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, all those things, right? And for me personally, Jesus Christ is the reason for my celebrating of the season, and that's fine. That's good. It's good for me, and I don't. There's a great Tecumseh quote out there. It says, "Trouble no one about the religion, but don't let anybody back you down from yours." Basically, that's paraphrasing Tecumseh what he said. So
that's great, man.
Yeah, I think everybody should look up that quote. If you'd never seen the movie Act of Valor, I think you should really look into that quote. I think it resonates through all people. That particular speech that he is saying to his people before he's going to battle and to death, he's speaking a lot of truth to the people that are coming after him, and he's basically expounding on the wisdom he's learned from his entire life. And I think it rings true with all people.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, reason why, like, the golden rule for family gatherings is leave politics and religion out of it, I don't know, unless you have something positive to say about it, I guess. But otherwise, like, if it's going to lead an argument, or if you're just, like, you know, bringing it up to poke the bear on, the occasion, like, don't do that.
Right, keep it simple. If it's positivity, do it. I just had a conversation with my two young boys about what is appropriate in our behavior in treating people. And if we notice somebody is not, if somebody is sad because of the way you're treating them, you need to change your behavior and also discuss why. You need to ask them, is this upsetting you? Okay. And then apologize about that and move forward. So I think those are, we need to get back to some of the simple things. That's the group of guys that I roll with in our bullfighting brotherhood, our small circle. We talk about simplicity because it's easy to complicate the game. Super easy.
Yeah, it is.
Break everything down to the simplest form, and like you just said, if anything in this season, use it as a reason to do good unto others, period.
Yeah,
simple as that. Don't need to take it any farther than that.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah, just simplified. If it's, you know, if it's getting in the way of something else, you know, like whether like it's upsetting you because now I have enough religion, too much religion, whatever your issue might be with it, you know. Like the, you know, I was reading a little bit before we got together about the, you know, part of the origin, you know, origin of Christmas, you know, it's the like Druid and Celtic holiday, you know, the solstice and Yule, you know, I was reading about the Yule log and you know, the lighting of candles and the celebrating the return of the sun and all these things, you know, and it's right. Just like, yeah, it's great, you know, just a gathering of people, you yep. know.
And a simple celebration of light, knowing those people knowing and watching the sun generally leave throughout the year and then truly celebrating that it was coming back again because it was going so far down the horizon. They don't know if it's coming back, you know, in simpler times.
Yeah.
And then those old traditions carried forward, and then they celebrate the light and once again gathering together. So, and if you want to take it deeper, let's celebrate the light within one another.
Yeah.
Let's talk about that. Let's remember the light that's within every one of us, especially the human race in all cultures has had some dark times recently among a lot of things. And I think there needs to be a big time change on the approach to one another. Search for the light. I'm glad you brought that up. At solstice time, look for the light within one another.
Yes, also just last weekend, and we had our own little celebration, which was pretty awesome, at our grandmother's house. I'd been in the family for a long time right there on the Missouri, and also where the Dearborn enters the Missouri, so it's kind of special waters for us.
Yes, absolutely.
Had a campfire and a little bonfire and you know, hung out.
Yeah, we were celebrating the solstice, I think almost inadvertently, but it was still within our blood to do so. We did it.
Yeah.
And we had a great campfire with a wonderful, with all our family members, you know, and it's celebrating some old land to us, a place that means a lot to all of us for sure. So
yeah,
that's cool. It's excellent.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And it was on my mind, and then I just, you know, got caught up in the moment. I forgot to bring it up when we were around the campfire, but you know, we had other things to discuss, you know, sharing stories and, you know, talking about like not really understanding exactly how the world worked. And, you know, our uncle being a big time, boatman.
Right.
You know, another thing that, you know, I was thinking about when we were talking about solstice and the horizon, like when ships would go beyond the horizon, no one knew where they went, you know? Mm-hmm. So, and if they're coming back, you know, like the widow's walk on those old houses, you know, just waiting for, or hoping, you know, that your loved one would come back to you. And, you know, and that's, and I think there's more celebration in the enjoying those moments. I mean, probably a lot more worry because, you know, like a lot more death than back in those days, but
right.
Also like a lot more celebrations and, you know, take like your return of a loved one, you know,
right.
Return of the sun, all those things, you know, and I think
yeah.
The appreciation, you know, and like you kind of were talking about too, like showing, your fellow humans a little more grace, you know, in
that's
these
right.
days.
Yeah, and the appreciation, I like that too. That's the right word for the times that we need to have is appreciation for the things, the events that are happening in your life, the people that are around you, your loved ones, moments like this where you can just sit. You know, people don't do this much anymore. Sit down, relax, have a pipe, tell stories, you know, share wisdom, share experiences. That's what we're doing, and we need to do more of it. I think that's why podcasting is really taking off, because it's allowing people to take a moment to sit down and be within a conversation and a story.
Yeah, absolutely, man. Like story times, you know, like we all grew up with them, you know, like you're reading stories, and especially like if you're our age, you know, and older, you probably had a little bit more of that action. Yeah, probably need to tamp that in, but
yeah.
I mean, just like the pipe and our great grandfather who had a boys club in Northern Illinois back in the day, you know, like he probably, I don't know, I just feel like he probably was telling us some stories as kids, you know, I don't remember it very well, but you know, just the smell of the pipe and like you said, the conversations kind of cued something in my brain that seemed familiar.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Well, I think, like you said, the human trait of the olfactory, our smell, sense of smell, that brings us back to memories and good or bad things. I think that's ingrained within our DNA to remember those things and like, oh, that's a good smell, good sensation. Oh, bad smell, bad things, not, you know, not good.
Yeah.
As simple as that, right? But like you say, I, you know, it's fun to carry on the tradition of the pipe. It's a good thing in moderation. It's, you know, it's a wonderful thing to enjoy.
Yeah, and once a year for me.
Yeah, exactly, right? That's very moderate. Yeah. And, it, you know, the smell of the pipe is enjoyable for others around you, too. It's not offensive like cigars and especially cigarettes. So I think
that's funny. Like, now that people don't smoke as much, I can smell a cigarette like a mile away.
Oh, man, so bad.
Yeah, it's nuts. I used to be kind of numb to it.
Yeah, then you go to the South Point for a week before the NFR, and, oh, man, can't hardly sleep at night, and you're feel like you smoked a couple packs of cigarettes.
Yeah. Breaking in the new pants, about to burn a hole in them.
Test them.
Yeah, Origin. See if the Origin tough.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, tell them. Not very seasoned to this. But yeah, it's weird. Like, the, you know, the Peanuts resonates with me so much. You know, the Charlie Brown Christmas, because growing up with it. But, like, even as a kid, I was like, huh. You know, like, when he's wrestling around with the meaning of Christmas and not feeling the spirit. You know, and then, you know, it loops back around where, you know, all his friends and even his dog are trying to make money off the holiday, you know. It's all commercial, you know, and that's what they kind of keep talking about. And he goes to a tree farm, and it's all, you know, about fake things and spending money. And then at the end, you know, his homies come together and around the tree and,
yeah,
you know, sing and celebrate the little tree that was kind of rough.
What a, yeah, exactly. What a simple story that Charles Schulz put together, and so meaningful, truthful, timeless too, right? That doesn't go away. It stands the test of time. No matter how many times you've seen a Charlie Brown Christmas, it always resonates every time with you, and it's brings you back to the first time you saw it when you're a kiddo. And then as you become an adult and you get more meaning out of it, you're like, oh, it's just a goofy little cartoon. But then honestly, there was a lot of meaning in that. Like you say, that everything was pretty bleak and very superficial, and at the end is a coming together of all of his friends, all the people around him, and they showed what the togetherness did for that tree. Everybody brought some of their own resources to add to that particular item, yeah. And then they're all together singing and enjoying each other's presence. There's no longer the worry about the play or the Christmas queen or the all these materialistic things. They didn't, you know, nobody cared about that anymore. They looked at the tree and realized there are characteristics within that tree, even though they laughed at it. They're like, oh, it's not such a bad little tree after all.
Totally. So. Yeah, and it was kind of cool because it showed, like, you know, Lucy's, even, like, her softer side. She's always kind of picking on Charlie Brown, you know, the, you know, usual pulling the football out from under him and letting him fall and,
right,
you know, making fun of him. And yeah, you know, when he goes to, I mean, he pays her, I guess, for her services at her booth there.
Yeah, the old psychology booth.
Yeah, and she's trying to diagnose him, and then, you know, at the end, she's just like, and she's right. She's like, you just need involvement, you know?
And that was true.
Yeah, and then, you know, she puts him as director of the play, which is a pretty big deal. So that was pretty cool, too, I thought.
Yeah, well, Charlie never had that opportunity before.
Yeah, he's at the beginning. He's, you know, he checks his mailbox, and he just, you know, says hello in there and gets the echo and nothing in there, and everyone's getting invited to all these Christmas parties and he's getting left out. And
yeah,
so yeah, it was a big deal, especially for him, like you said. But like, that's, I mean, all these Christmas movies have a really good meaning to them, you know. Like, It's a Wonderful Life is also one of the ones that are high on my list, and we were talking earlier about just being nicer to folks, and I mean, it just shows just what impact you can have on someone's life, even if it's just little, you know. It goes a long way. And by George getting removed from his own life and never existing, it shows the different path that it led all his friends and family on, and it wasn't good, you know.
Yeah, nobody was better off, that's for sure.
Yeah,
it was a bleak world without him, and he had made, you and I talked about it earlier, he had made choices that were directly predicated in integrity. He knew it was the right thing to do, even though it wasn't the most comfortable or most enjoyable thing for him.
Yeah,
all of his personal plans got put by the wayside every time, until he was finally gaining success, and then loses the money when the bank inspector's there, and he's hit his limit. It's game over, you know. He thinks anyway.
Yeah,
but he doesn't stop to realize how many resources, how many people he's, you know, their lives are touched us telling our dad when we were sitting down watching the movie, one of the guy that wanted all of his money that he had at the Bacon Loan, I hated that guy at the beginning of watching that movie. Hated him because he wouldn't compromise.
Yeah.
And then the people after him, you know, $20, and then the one gal, $17.50, and he kisses her because, you know, that's all she wants.
Oh,
wanted.
Yeah, when they're doing the run on the bank.
Yeah, and he's giving away his personal money from his wedding because they don't have cash on hand.
To his honeymoon, yeah.
Yeah, because it's the building and loan, and that money is invested in everybody else's home, as he was explaining. You'll get your money in 60 days, but we have to glean that money out. It's not sitting in a big safe here.
Yeah.
We're not a bank like that. And did I not like that guy. And then he is one of the very first guys to come into George's home after he comes back. And he says, hey, George, another run on the bank? And smiles at him and winks and pours a whole bunch, probably all the money he took from George or from the building and loan.
Yeah.
Maybe not that much, but he had a pocket full of money, had a pile, and he was putting it into the kitty for George. And he smiled at him, and I thought, man, I never really noticed that part too much. But as an adult, you see it, and it's just that movie. It's heavy, man.
Yeah.
But good. It's great.
Oh, it's great.
But it's heavy.
Yeah, it is heavy. Cool, because even like his last stand when he's on the bridge about to take his own life, he's got his life insurance policy, and that's the only thing that's going to save the building alone. And
so he thinks, you know.
It's the only money he has, you know, and the only thing that's worth anything to him, like you said, so he thinks. So even his last desperation of him taking his own life was to save the building alone and you know, his relatives and everybody else.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
With his own life insurance plan.
Sure, and Potter planted that seed.
Oh, yeah.
The evil. He said, you're worth more dead than you are alive.
Yeah, man, yeah. That guy plays a good evil guy, holy. But, yeah, that was pretty eye-opening for him to actually, you know, go run around the town that even the name was changed.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's great. It's pretty amazing. Great acting, great storyline. You know, whoever, I don't know who the story writer, the writer is for that whole screenplay and that movie, but whoever, I mean, awesome.
Yeah, it's amazing.
Great job.
Yeah, it's really cool, because like you were saying, like, timeless films, you know, like, the best Christmas films, at least, are timeless, you know, like, all the Washington Irving stuff. I think he did Holiday Inn and White Christmas.
Yeah.
White Christmas, for sure. And, I mean, that guy was just incredible.
Yeah, and, you know, back then, too, they didn't just write the dialogue or the script, but they wrote the music. They wrote the songs.
That's what I was thinking, yeah.
Man, it's just amazing.
Like White Christmas is,
Yeah, I watched
a staple.
Yeah, I watched the...
The song, I mean, even...
Right, yeah, exactly. I watched the credits for that, and I thought, man, what an amazing, talented individual that didn't write... You know, didn't just direct, didn't just write some of the dialogue, but wrote the music and composed the music, you know, and wrote the songs, the lyrics. Incredible. And that's, I don't know.
Yeah.
Like you say, those movies. And so far, those movies haven't been replicated or replaced, you know, they're just timeless.
No, it's so cool. And just to see, just kind of peer in that world is what I like about, you know, like White Christmas and Holiday Inn, you know, and Holiday Inn, especially because, you know, it shows him writing the music all the time. You know,
right.
Like, mm-hmm. He, for all the different holidays, he's writing the music and then performing the music, you know, with his dance partner.
Mm-hmm.
And, then Hollywood comes knocking and he doesn't want anything to do with it, but, you know, his dance partner leaves him and then, he comes, you know, back around. But it's cool because, you know, he'd written White Christmas, you know, in that movie, you know, being the, you know, singer, songwriter, and
right,
really, I think Washington Irving wrote the song, but it's just cool how he, you know, like, it kind of showed him do it, and then it comes loops back around the end of Holiday Inn with him, you know, singing the song and breaking in on the set.
Yeah, I like that.
Yeah,
I like that a lot.
Yeah, it's cool, man, and just like you said, because even back then, I mean, TV, you know, at least it's been being portrayed like in White Christmas, post World War II, and you know, not a lot of TV going on. Most people were wanting to go get their performance, live performance,
yeah. Right? Yeah, the shows were still the thing, you know, and they still are. You go down to Vegas and stuff. Hey, you're going to go see a show, which is cool. I mean, that's great. And or Broadway, you know, our grandmother was very culturally inclined and took us to go see the Nutcracker Suite, you know, a couple different plays, which were incredible to watch. You know, as a kid at first, I don't want to go to that. And then you go to a live, you know, show, a screening, you know, or a play, and you're like, man, this is actually really, really engaging, really intriguing.
Yeah. You know? It's so much better. You know, like you see like the Rockettes on, you know, like the Thanksgiving Macy's parade, and they, you know, do like a small performance. But if you actually go to see the Rockettes, yeah, you know, like it's a whole different beast.
Yeah, I thought that was, when we went, I was like, no way, you know, like, why are we going?
Yeah.
And then by the end of it, you're just like completely enthralled. Like these performers are amazing. The music is amazing. The production is outstanding. Everything's so well done. I went to see the Lion King from a gift from a good friend that we went over as a group to go watch it in Spokane, dressed up nice to go see the show. Yeah. Wore a tie, wore a nice hat, and man, what an enjoyable experience! What a production that was! Incredible. And I mean, that production just wasn't on the stage; it surrounded you. It was all around you. Yeah, it was great. They came from different areas behind you down the aisles and stuff. I don't want to ruin it for anybody. I mean, I'm sure The Lion King is still showing and you should go see it. It's worth it.
Yeah.
It's great.
Well, yeah, like you said, those good ones always circle. Like Wicked, you know, has been going on forever, you know.
Right.
I think a few people didn't want it to see it brought to like the big screen because it kind of takes a little bit of the magic of the live performance away, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. That's
what that is. But I remember some people not really liking that it was going to be a movie, but it looked like they did a good job with the movie. I never saw the play, so I can't say much, but...
No, yeah.
But like you said, the Nutcracker, and you know, it was like a tradition on our mom's side, and going to all the different spots, like you said, like I remember we went to a pretty nice auditorium somewhere, theater, and it's like thinking I was, you know, underdressed as a kid even, and feeling a little stuffy in there, but the performance was great, and then we had... We went to like some high school or maybe some small college performance of it at one point, you know, one year, and it was just as good, you know, and a little bit of different flavor. And that's the thing with live performance, every night's a little different, you know.
Right, a different show every night.
Yeah.
No matter what, you could go to, like you say, you could go to several consecutive shows and you're going to see it. It will play out differently each night just because of the human component. It's going to have a varied timing, I guess, varied cadence.
Yeah, and the chemistry is a little different night to night. You know, people are, you know, bringing different energies. And the, like, you know, example, I got a chance to be in Fiddler on the Roof back in high school, and I was just more helping out, but I don't really have a talent for acting. But the, you know, all our friends did, you know, like Kinsey Cowling and Jill Hansen and, you know, Travis Henningsen, all those folks from our high school days, and then the Pantojas and the Butte, you know, Central folks that came over to help, you know, pull that play off, because Whitehall did not have enough folks to field the play like that. I mean, Fiddler on the Roof is huge.
Yeah.
And I can't remember who the lead was. This is wild that I remember. I think Tavi's the lead character, and I can't remember. I think it was a Butte fella, and he crushed it. He was great.
That's awesome.
But like you said, I got to be a part of it. It was like a 3 or 4 night show at the Motherlode Theater, which in Butte, Montana is, I mean, I don't know. I'm not that cultured. I haven't been to that many theaters, but I would put the Motherlode against any theater.
Oh, yeah.
That place is amazing.
What an environment.
Huge. Like, I'd been a part of some small high school plays, you know, like being part of the, you know, drama class was one of the electives, either that or choir. So I picked drama, and a little more fun, a little more interactive, you know, with the drama class. So
yeah, definitely.
I picked that instead of choir because I also can't sing. And But, you know, we had that production in our high school stage, you know, in the gym. And,
right.
It's just a small little thing. And then you go in the Motherlode and you're like, holy cow.
Yeah,
like,
what a different feeling.
There could be some big, and I bet there has been some big productions.
I'll guarantee you. Yeah, when it was in its height, all you have to look is at the decor and the construction and the architecture of that building and the buildings that are around it. And you're like, oh, man, I bet this was... I'm sure it was packed, and it was a heck of a show. I bet it was amazing.
Every night of the week.
It had to be like Broadway at the one point. I mean, Butte was one of the most populated cities in the United States. You know, I mean, there are families, generations of families from outside of our country that know right where Butte, Montana is, a.k.a. Butte, America.
Yeah, Butte, America.
Don't stop in America. Go all the way to Butte.
That's,
you know, big Irish saying. And I'm sure a lot of the other cultures that were in, you know, in Butte, their families were saying the same thing. Don't just stop when you hit America. That's what they thought when you go to Ellis Island. Don't just stop there. Keep going till you get to Butte. And Butte was, they didn't exactly know where, you know, if you can just picture like the idea of this blank map and Butte's just sitting way out there to the west somewhere. Yeah. They had no idea, you know, states or, you know, regions or anything like that. They just said, they knew, get to your other family members. They're in Butte, they're mining and they're doing good.
Yeah.
So that's where you need to go. You'll make some money. You'll have a chance.
Yes. Yeah. Especially during like the Great Depression days and stuff, you know.
Right. There was an opportunity.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. They're mining that copper.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, crazy town, and luckily, in a weird way, that when, you know, the economy took a little crash back in the day, the and I was talking to the owner of the of Metals Bank, which is, you know, super cool building uptown, and he turned the office buildings up top into apartments for people who don't know, and my wife was renting out one of the apartments, so we stayed in there for a little while, and, I mean, it was awesome, and he just gave us a little, like, oral tour. Speaking of like storytelling, he gave a little storytelling of the area and
how
the
cool is that?
Neighborhood building. Yeah, super cool.
There's, Butte loves that too, right? Because it has a cultural depth to it of many cultures.
Yeah.
So people in Butte, go to the tours, go check it out.
Oh man,
go to the speakeasy tour, go to the underground tour, go to the tour of Butte. Go to the, you know, the historical tour. Check out the city hall there. Holy,
oh man,
talk about marble and granite and precious metals woven into all the things, and murals and paintings. You think Butte is a dirty old little town? Well, kind of, but you're missing Butte. You're missing the big picture. I love Butte.
I love it, man. It. Especially like back in the late 90s, early 2000s when we were stomping around Butte a lot. Like, it definitely had kind of a rough exterior. But, you know, it's cleaned up quite a bit in the last few years, especially for that 23 or whatever that came through. And it sounded like they did a good job, too, because they're restoring buildings instead of, like, tearing anything down,
right.
You know, they're bringing it back to its glory. And because there was a spot, like, over by Ocoma, I think that's on, is that on Continental Park? I don't know, one of those, you know, east-west streets uptown.
Yeah, kind of uptown.
Uptown Butte there, and a lot of those empty, look, abandoned-looking buildings, and I heard they're fixing them up for 23 and using them, which was what they needed.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, like you said, I mean, there's so many nice things under the surface. Like you drive by the courthouse and you're just like thinking like, oh yeah, the normal old looking building. But you walk in, like you said, the paintings and murals and marble work and all that stuff. Like I went in there to get my passport back in the day, and I was like, holy cow! Like it, I was in there probably for an extra hour.
Oh yeah,
you know, just 100%. Like working my way slowly. The passport office was almost closed by the time I got there because I was just like taking my time walking my way up there because like this is amazing.
All the murals, all the paintings. Yeah. Which reminds me, I really need to see our state capitol at some point. I want to see all the massive Charlie Russell paintings and everything else. Not just his artwork, but local artwork. You know, the statue of Thomas Marr on the outside. All that. I want to see all of that. But yeah, I think that analogy of what you just said about some of the rough exteriors, rough facades that you see of Butte, then you go inside and you see this immaculate beauty. And I think it's a great analogy for the town, for the culture there.
Yeah.
You're going to be met with a rough exterior, but if you just hang in there and remain humble and receptive to the people that are across from you, you're going to find an amazing culture there.
Yeah,
amazing.
Man.
Real stubborn culture.
Yeah.
They're not going to give you much leeway on some things, which is fine. That's their way.
Yep.
But at the same time, you're going to find some wonderful things.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, man. Yeah, some of my best buddies, you know, came from Butte that, you know, have my back to the end. And but vice versa, though. You know, they don't just give it, you know, like,
yep.
And they know I'm, you know, I got their back to the end, too.
That's the same deal. Well, it's what's expected.
Yeah.
And what you would do. It's required, but that's what you're going to do, too, you know.
Yeah, and, you know, for folks from Montana listening, and they already know this, so I'm not telling anything new, but, like, Tommy Malott for the Montana State University Bobcats, who are playing in the championship game in Frisco. Is that New Year's Day?
No, I think it's going to be January 6th is what
January
I read.
6th. Oh, yeah. Gotcha. Yeah, so coming up here, you know, undefeated season, Tommy Malott, quarterback from Butte, Montana, and just, you know, to me, the, like, picture of class. Like,
yeah.
In his first game battling against the Grizz, which is the big rivalry, University of Montana versus Montana State University, Bobcats versus Grizzlies. And, I mean, right away he just, like, acknowledges the Grizz after they just – beat the snout out of the Grizz, if I remember right, in Bozeman. And so, like, you know, the fans are all rowdy, and he's like, "Hey, let's just take a minute to acknowledge the Grizz. You know, they came out here, they gave it their all, and fortunately, we got the best of them in this game. But they played a really good game, so let's show them a little respect. Leave their bus alone, and leave them alone. Yeah. Let's just enjoy our win here." And it was great. I mean, he was like a freshman when he said that. Like, that's a huge thing for anybody.
A lot of class, man.
Yeah, a lot of class.
Shows what Butte is right there, you know.
That's what I was thinking, man. I mean, yeah, they grow up a little more mature or something. They're a little tougher or something, man.
It's, yeah, some accountability that's required there. And like you say, a hardened interior because it's, you know, just living in a tough area. I mean, even the weather's tough there.
Yeah, it is, man. It's always a little colder.
You got to be, your toughness is a requirement in Butte. But also there's a, like you said, there's a class there that goes deeper. And I think he has because of being from Butte, he has an awareness of what's going around him too. He pays attention, you know.
Hard working.
Yep,
dude.
Hard working, man. Yeah, that's the whole reason he's in the position he's in is because he's all hard work, in my opinion. You know, he's got unreal, God given ability. But you and I both, you know, we know that there's no such thing as pure talent. There just isn't.
No.
There's only work. You outwork everybody else, and you'll find yourself in successful places. You will. There's no talent is, yeah. That's a fallacy in my, that's my humble opinion. You have genetic abilities, there's no doubt about that. But if you don't develop those things, you're going nowhere. And work is what develops those things. Yeah. So there's a story about a very young pianist. He was like 10, 12 years old. And he plays some music on a day show or something like that. I can't remember, but it was for some kind of, you know, they were exposing him as a prodigy. And they said, "Man, you have all this amazing talent, you know, this God-given talent." And they just kept using the word talent. They kept saying, "All these gifts you've been given." And he finally stopped them. He was like 10 or 12 years old. He said, "You keep saying these things like I was just born, that I was able to do this. This is working every single day. More hours than most people work in a day, daily on a piano, until I hated it and then loved it again and then hated it and then loved it again. And now I'm in a position where I have a mastery over this, over myself in this, and now I have a connection. Now I can express myself spiritually into this instrument. And you call that a talent, a gift?" And he was just, rightfully so, he was pretty upset about that. And I was like, "Man, that makes all the sense in the world. Sonny Bill, how much is God-given talent and how much is all hard work?" He's like, "All hard work."
Yeah.
Period.
Yeah, period. Yeah. Sonny Bill Williams, rugby player.
Yeah.
Yeah, New Zealand. Yeah, exactly. And that was great to see because, like, you know, just looking, you know, like a Sonny Bill Williams, you know, he's like this genetic-looking freak, you know, size-wise and talented-wise. But, like, yeah, that's all, like, I mean, you got the height, but, I mean, you got to put the muscle and build
If he didn't develop any of that, he wouldn't look that way. They think he just looks like that because he was born that way.
Yeah, exactly. No.
He developed that.
Yeah.
Through pain and sweat and injury.
Yeah, And that's the thing, too, overcoming injury. Anyone who's a professional in a sport, you know, it's especially, like, yeah, injury is the thing that really separates the champions from you know, never was kind of people.
That's
you
it.
Know?
Yeah. You're going to be, no matter what, you're going to be presented with potential game-changing barriers, career-ending barriers. It's how you overcome those barriers is determines what that career path is going to look like for you or that choice that you made.
Yeah.
And some people make them better. It's the hardening of the steel. So their steel becomes harder and better and stronger because of that fold put into them, the analogy that we've shared before.
Yeah.
So that's no different than taking your steel to the forge. The ones that come out successful and look that strong, they come out of that because of the effort they put in, and it made them stronger. It didn't hold them back, didn't make them weaker. People wouldn't even know that happened to them, you know?
Yeah.
There's so many of the greatest athletes. You think Michael Jordan went through his whole career without injury? No, absolutely not. You know,
yeah, exactly.
I mean, Kobe Bryant breaking his ankle during the finals. I mean, there's so many different stories. You know, everybody thought Walter Payton was just an infallible machine. You know, Barry Sanders. I mean, there's, the list goes on. Anybody who ever plays at the level of professional sport, they experience injury at some point.
Oh, yeah.
Almost everybody.
Yeah, 100%. Your body can only take so much, and then it's like a numbers game too. Eventually, you're gonna get hit by a weird angle, especially like in football or rugby or you know, something that's like a collision sport. Even soccer, you know, like
anything.
Yeah, one of the nastiest knee injuries I ever saw was in high school soccer, where knees got collided. And
Look, even professional golfers, they're not getting hit by anybody, but a repetitive motion and giving their everything they have on every swing. How many knee injuries that did Tiger Woods have?
Well, see, and his back's all been messed up for years. When he's loose, he's still playing, you know, with the best of them. But with his
that's what John Daly's so good, man. He stayed loose.
Yeah, exactly.
Cigarettes and beers, whiskey
and the booze.
If he was sitting here, he'd be laughing at both of us the way we're talking about injury and overcoming. But John's his own animal. You know, he's the mental champion.
Yeah,
you know, John, nothing phases him mentally at all.
Yeah, totally.
Coolest cucumber in the freaking bunch, man.
Yeah, and that's a that's a huge thing too, is to be able to have that ability. You know, is to I'm gonna work it out. You know, even if you're hitting all the sand traps and in the rough, you know, like you keep that positive mental attitude, and you start finding the fairway more. And
that's right. They call some of those shots at the shot after is a golf shot or a recovery shot for a reason, because the game is not out of reach. You can still recover. How many times have you seen that? You know, like Bubba Watson hits it into the pine duff and has to make a ridiculous shot out of the woods, a 90-degree turn, it ends on the green. How he did it, nobody still to this day. I don't know how he did it.
Yeah.
But one of the greatest things I ever saw. I mean, his game should have been over. His opponent had the mental advantage. They're playing on a sudden-death hole. It's a playoff hole. They're both tied up in the Masters. Who's going to get the green jacket, and Bubba makes that shot. And mentally, you can see what it did for him and for his adversary. It flipped the whole script all the way over. Like, the energy completely changes. The momentum is in a whole different boat.
Yeah,
the crowd, everything, right?
Yeah, totally. Well, it's like that grind video I keep sharing, you know, about momentum. You know, he says momentum's a cruel mistress, and it can change at the drop of a dime, you know, or drop of a hat. And it's, and in the video, it shows, you know, it's talking about the TCU baseball team, and it shows the guy just going to get a, you know, recover a grounder, you know, second baseman or whoever, shortstop, and it takes a weird hop, and, you know, he totally misses it. It's like, you never know. And then it's hard to get that momentum to swing back in your way, but you just got to keep, you know, pushing. And eventually, you know, like, if you got enough time left in the game, you usually get it to swing back your way.
Yeah. I think if you have a relentless attitude, nothing is over. Nothing's game over. I think if you remain relentless, there is no over until the last whistle blows. I think that's the champion's mentality.
Totally.
The game's not over ever in your mind until they blow the whistle till it's actually over. And then the game, that part of that game continues all the way through into your training, into the next game, makes you better for the next game.
Yeah.
So you don't have a repeat performance of that.
Yeah, because they talk about with young teams and young athletes just trying to build that mental toughness, because you have someone like Patrick Mahomes who never quits, and you know, like, Chiefs are never out of it, man. You know, like, they've come back in so many games, and if they have the ball towards the end of the game, it's, you know, theirs to lose, and they're not doing that very often.
Right, and that's the mental – that's a culture you create within your program, right? And that's a culture you want to create in yourself, in your household, in your family, in your peer group. That's the culture you want to have, that winning mentality.
Yeah, totally, and bring each other up, you know, like the team thing, and that kind of circles back to even just the holidays here, you know, just like trying to, you know, make each other better and bringing that, you know, attitudes are like viruses, you know. So if you are dreading going like that Christmas party or something, you know, or family gathering, and you come in with a bad attitude, like, it's not helping anybody. But if you're just like, oh,
that,
whatever.
That will propagate.
Yeah,
and if you adopt the
Griswold mentality.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Clark W. Yeah. Love that guy. That dude was a champion. He had fortitude. Even though he lost it a couple times, he got her back on track with a few helpful hints from his dad and his peer group. He salvaged the ship.
Yeah, you don't know we're trying to abandon ship, you know.
Yeah, oh no.
Right.
No, nobody's running out on this one.
Yeah.
No, we're all in this together, and he was right. He was right. And I think those are the organizations, you know, I've had the tremendous fortune to work with organizations and people where the overwhelming attitude is, let's lift each other up. How do we help each other? And those are the successful groups of people, organizations, whether it's business, rodeo companies, you know, whatever, financial group, anything, anybody I've ever been involved in, just coworkers. If you adopt the attitude of helping each other out, it's going to be successful. And even if it's not a good day, your day is sure a lot better than what it would have been if you're not trying to help each other out.
100%, man. And that's where I found, you know, a lot of great people in the wildland world, like the wildland firefighter world, and firefighters in general, but like especially like wildland firefighters, because that's, you know, more of my background. And where, like, you know, being pretty much out of it now, but also like coming from the Pinnacle, it's still cool because there's still that like let's, you know, what are we doing? Like, we're all in this together. Let's rally, you know, like we're trying to get, you know, the pay thing going for folks. And
right.
I might not see it in my career. And even if I do, it's, you know, it's not going to add to much, you know, at this point towards the end of my career, but it's still like, I'm still fighting for the, you know, the first year firefighter folks who are like, this is life changing. You know, they're like, sure, they'll make a sustainable wage. But you know, so this love I have for the wildland firefighters in everywhere is, you know, huge, because it's that, right? Like, it's that we're bringing each other up. Like, I got invited to the Wildland Firefighter Foundation Flathead Chapter banquet in Kalispell last year, and it was cool. I haven't spent much time in Kalispell and never been to the fairgrounds, so I don't really know what I was doing. And Justin Caber, you know, he's busy orchestrating all this, and I mean, they brought a Coors banquet semi in there. I mean, this place is huge where the banquet was at. And you know, it's got the mural, or it's got a picture of a wildland firefighter, you know, on the job.
Oh yeah, cool.
Yeah, it's super cool. And Coors has donated a ton of money to the Wildland Firefighter Foundation.
Yeah, good on them.
Yeah, they cut a check at the NFR last year, I think it was, to Burke Miner, the you know, head of the Wildland Firefighter Foundation. Him and his mom started back in the 90s. And
nice.
Super cool, man. And a special moment, Burke talked to me a little bit on the podcast, you know, and I mean, it was just cool for all of us wildland firefighter folks, and just that amount of money helps so many families. I mean, we're losing firefighters all the time. But back to Justin Caber, I'd never met the guy before. You know, he just, you know, found my podcast and was liking what I was doing, and just trying to share stories and you know, spread the outreach for wildland firefighters and my little part. And it's not very big, but he's like, hey, why don't you come up and be part of the banquet? Bring the Airstream, man. We'll, you know, put it out there. And at first, I thought he was just like, be parked outside, you know.
All right, yeah.
And then he's like, yeah, well, we'd actually like to bring it in there, you know. And on the other side of the stage, I was like, well, I got to get this thing shined up. But as he's like, kind of telling me the ins and outs of this banquet, you know, I'd never been before, heard about it, but never been. And you know, kind of all the things that they're doing and how they're raising their money and the different stations and the flow of the evening and stuff. And he's like, I was like, yeah, it's cool, man. Thank you so much for being a part of it. You know, I feel like we're all lifting each other up. He's like, yeah, man, you make it, we make it. I make it, or we make it, you make it. He's like, we're all in this together, man. Like, yeah. I'm like, exactly, dude. That's what I've been, you know, wanting to kind of like, you know, talk about and you know, communicate. It's like, we're all in this together. You know, it's like Wildland Firefighter Foundation, National Spokesjumper Association, Lookout Podcast, like, it's all together, and like we all are lifting each other up. And that's, like you said, I think it's not a if, it's a when it all like really starts taking off and get the word out there and get the firefighter pay and get, you know, more people aware of the foundation and want to donate because it's a great cause. You know,
absolutely. And nobody's losing in that endeavor.
No,
you know,
exactly.
The wildlands are going to be better protected. You're going to have better people, more committed to that. I mean, all of it. When it's a sustainable career for someone, you have people that are going to be more invested personally into that.
Yeah.
And more technology invested in everything. It's all, like you said, and then the idea that one person gets to the goal line, they're bringing everybody else with them kind of thing. Like, you win, I win too. That's the whole thing. Like, you make it, I make it. That saying's great. I love that.
Yeah, it's great. Yeah.
Watching somebody go up to the summit of Everest and then turn around and say, okay, everybody else, I've got the end of the rope, you're coming with me, or you're attached to this rope, you're part of that summit.
Totally, man. Yeah, one of the most successful alpinists, I guess, or climbers, you know, is that Nims fell in. And that's what is that his attitude, man, is awesome, you know.
Yeah.
And like, I mean, in that documentary of, was it 14 Peaks or something like that? Everything, you know, the 14 peaks, there's 14 peaks in the world, I think above 8,000 meters, you know, and he was going to set the record and do it all in like a year's time. And
oh, right,
never been done, you know.
I never had seen that. Yeah.
Yeah. I got to check it out. It's awesome. But at 2 points, you know, he was run into, you know, like people who were smoked, and they were like, "No, nah, it ain't happened this year." And there's, you know, years where the weather's just really bad, especially on like K2. And he's on this one, and I can't remember the name of it, but it's one of the worst. But it just doesn't get the press because, you know, it's not as big as Everest, not as popular as Everest or K2. But, and it's probably not as many people attempt it because it sounds horrible. I mean, they show this like video of it, and it's like the whole thing is like shaking and avalanches, you know, like going off of this, just shedding off this thing, right? And
gnarly.
This, really great climber from, I think he's from the US, like, cool dude, you know, tough guy, you know, he's doing these climbs, and he had tried a couple times and just kept having to turn around because of weather or conditions or whatever. And, so he's like, Nims is going up, so he joins in with Nims, and they're good ways up, and it's getting pretty heinous. And he's like, yeah, he turns to Nims, and he's like, "We're gonna turn around, man. We're not gonna be able to do it." And that's when that like famous quote from Nims is like, "No, that's not in our blood. Quitting's not in our blood. We're good to the top." And he says it a lot cooler than I just said it, but
yeah,
and they did it. You know, yeah. He's like, no quit, you know, positive attitude, and made it to the top. And then kind of similar thing with K2, like the normal route was just not good. I think it was just like it was warm or something, and they're having like way more avalanche danger. And yeah, I think that almost took out a group of climbers. And so he's like, well, we'll go the other way that people used to go, or, you know, other ways to go. And
it's another way.
Yep. And they set their own ropes, and he, but like that attitude thing, he came in, I think he brought a bunch of booze, cooked food for the whole camp. It was like, and then tomorrow morning we're going to get after it.
Let's change the morale.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Let's get
everybody on a positive note. He did. Yeah. He was wise enough to know. We need to get everybody together and pointed in one direction with a great attitude, too.
Totally, man.
Everybody needs to be excited about where we're all going.
Yeah.
That's cool.
Yeah.
It's really good.
And that resonates with me so much because, like, even like the stuff we were talking with the holiday spirit and the gathering, you know, it's like, man, like it's... Gathering is a special thing, and storytelling and all those are great, you know, like that's
right.
Why like a lot of those old Christmas movies people are reading the night before Christmas, you know, it's like special, man, you know, the kids get around and it kind of quiets, slows things down for the evening, gets everybody ready for, you know, going to sleep and waking up to a beautiful morning and presents and food and whatever else you got going on for your traditions.
Yeah, I agree with that. Yes, and you're setting the environment, right? You're providing the setting of the situation, you know, and bringing back good memories, and those good memories of Christmases before, just like, you know, the songs, scary ghost stories and tales of the stories of Christmases long, long ago. It reminds you immediately of all those fun things as a child, things that were magic to you, and then you can pass that off to the children of your family and friends. And like at work the other day, we're sharing stories of why do you do certain traditions that you do. Well, because it was magic for me, you know, as a kiddo, and I want to share that same magic. And then we get to feel a little piece of that magic again, you know, looking in the eyes of our kids and our Sean and I's little niece, your daughter, and your little son, who's, you know, he's obviously new enough. His eyes are wide open, like, what is actually happening?
Yeah, there's no idea what's going on.
It's great too. Yeah. Love it. So getting to share some of those traditions we have, you know, last night, and watching the magic unfold with my boys, with your daughter, it's cool, you know?
Yeah, it's huge, man. Like, yeah, those traditions being passed down, and it's been in our DNA, you know, since, like, the beginning of time, you know, like, storytellers in the beginning, because no one, even if they wrote stuff down, it wasn't lasting. They didn't have any way to preserve it, really, you know, like now, you know, so.
That's true.
Yeah, some, you know, cave stories and stuff like that, but nothing to the level we have today with books and
Oral history will stand the test of time always, still, you know, it always will be there. And that's something that is innately a human thing too, recalling and reciting that story, you know, and that oral history, right?
Totally, man. And yeah, one last little, you know, tidbit for folks, or nugget for folks who are, you know, going to attend a gathering. I heard the chef, and it might have been on No Reservations, or maybe something else. You know, I watch all these cooking shows as much as I can because I'm always trying to glean something. But this one chef was super cool. He's like, if I'm invited to a dinner party or a gathering, he's like, I'm bringing two things. I'm bringing something really nice to drink, whether it's a bottle of wine or brandy or whatever it might be, whiskey. And he's like, and I'm bringing a story. He's like, I make sure I have a story. I have a good story, a really good story to tell. Those are the two things I bring.
Oh, man.
And this was like a really awesome chef. And I was like,
simple and beautiful is that?
Yeah.
And it just rounds out the entire evening. These are the two greatest things I can bring.
Yep.
I'm not imposing on the meal or anything that else that's happening. I'm going to bring a wonderful
spirit.
Yeah. And they call it a spirit for a reason. And then added to that spirit, I'm going to bring a story. And a prepared story. Something that I know this is going to fit the evening.
Yeah.
This is going to fit the group of people I'm going. And I want to share this. This is something that was left such an impression on me. I'm going to share this with the people that I feel deserve to hear it, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, which is huge. You know, huge. Yeah, that's and kind of old school, you know?
Very.
So that always stuck with me. It's like, that's great.
Yeah, it's outstanding. Yeah. I think it's great.
Bring those two
things. How simple is that? Then you don't have to think about anything else.
Yeah.
I'm going to bring something to drink and a story.
Yeah, especially you got a nice camp.
So classy.
Yeah, if you got a nice fireplace or something to gather around, or you know, even if it's just like your dining room table and share both those things, you know, it's pretty powerful stuff.
Yeah.
And people remember those things, you know.
Oh, yeah, and that's been the tradition for the test of time, you know, the sit around and share a story. That was what we'd been doing as human beings forever, you know, especially during the gathering season, you know.
Yeah.
I like that. I think that's goes right back to our beginnings, you know, resonates in the DNA. Like this is what we were about. We sit down, share a story, tell me a story. You know, the proprietor of the home, whoever the patriarch, the matriarch of the home, I think that was almost a requirement. Like, let's sit down. Tell me your story. Tell me a story.
Yeah. You know,
entertain us with a story. Yeah, get us all together.
Regale us. Yeah.
Regale us with a story. Yeah.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I even see it in like the, and this, I think that's Washington Irving story as well as Headless Horseman, Ichabod Crane, you know, Sleepy Hollow. And, you know, like they go over to, is it Van Tassel's home?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, at the end of the night, you know, like after they all got done eating, it's like he was kind of expecting a story, and Brahm comes up with a, you know, Headless Horseman tale, and even being, you know, being the narrator, said that Van Tassel loved a good scary story, and
yeah, exactly.
So Brahm brought that one, and
which was also part of his ulterior motive, which was good.
Yeah,
worked good for him.
Yeah, totally. But yeah, it was kind of cool because, you know, he's battling wits with a school teacher and losing, you know.
Losing at every corner.
Yeah. And then finally sees a chink in the armor and goes for it.
Yeah. Yeah, big one. A fatal character flaw.
Yeah, character flaw, yeah.
Yeah. Ichabod. Unfortunately, Ichabod wasn't, I would say, the most genuine individual.
Yeah.
You know, at the end of it.
No. Yeah, that's kind of cool thing about storytelling, too, and you know, last thing before I let you go, because it's getting late and Christmas, you know.
Yeah.
But the how stories can change, you know, depending on who the person is who's, you know, like now it's like a director or producer of a movie, but like anything, you know, the person telling the story can change things to, you know, spice it up or whatever, you know, like the cartoon Ichabod was kind of a dirtbag. And I didn't realize as a kid, and then you get older, you're like, oh, yeah.
Yeah.
You know, like
I was on Ichabod's side as a kid. I thought it was like, why is he picking on him?
Yeah.
It's because he's not a good guy.
No, exactly. He's just trying to, you know, he's trying to
get something from everybody in town.
Everybody. You know? Yeah. And then sees the big farm that Katrina's dad has.
Yeah. He sees a cash cow. He sees, yeah, he sees an opportunity to become wealthy.
Yep. Yeah. He just, yeah, he's picturing himself and her dad's, you know, attire.
Right. Yeah.
And chair and everything.
Not working for it either, just by marrying someone.
Yeah, marrying into it, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And you're like, oh, that's a bad character. And then you see, like, the Johnny Depp, Sleepy Hollow, and he's, like, this educated, what am I thinking of? Like, Sherlock Holmes type of character. He's a...
Oh, I gotcha.
Yeah, I think he's constable or something, but he's, like, a detective.
Gotcha.
And have you not seen that one?
Yeah, I have. It's been a long time. I mean, it was a great film. Yeah.
Yeah, it was like the town of Sleepy Hollow written to like the city, like, hey, we're having this issue and like we need some help. And then
need an investigator.
Yeah.
And somebody's got to come and see why this is happening.
Yes. They send Ichabod down there. And it's cool. So it's different. And he's, you know, educated, but a little more brave in that one and a lot more brave in that one. And, you know, a little different story.
Who's the horseman? Is it Chris Walken?
Yeah.
That's awesome.
It's really awesome.
He's a scary guy anyway.
Yeah, scary guy anyway. And on the, I mean, that's a really good, and it's also cool because you got like the more of the kid version, which is also kind of scary for really young kids, but then you got like the more of the adult version that's could be kind of scary for anybody watching, especially for the first time.
Yeah.
But, well, thanks for joining me on Christmas, my friend.
Yeah, Merry Christmas, and a Merry Christmas to you, sir, as Ebenezer Scrooge said at the end, especially when I just got done watching that film with my kiddo, so it's, you know, on my heart right here and right now. So
yeah. Well, that's another good story about like people can change, you know. Like,
yeah,
there's always some hope,
right?
That's like the kind of thin thread in a lot of the Christmas movies, is, you know, the hope that they're gonna, you know, see the better in humans and in themselves, especially.
Yeah, I think it makes me laugh because I'm as guilty of it, I should say, phrase that, I'm as guilty as anyone, that when I hear the name The Grinch or Ebenezer Scrooge, immediately I think of them as bad.
Villains, yeah.
Yeah, but they're not. By the end of it,
yeah,
the Grinch is the kindest person within Whoville. It brings everybody's stuff back and tries to restore all things and becomes the keeper of Christmas. Ebenezer Scrooge, he became as good a man as the city ever knew, and that he kept Christmas in his heart better than anyone ever knew.
Yeah.
Right? He was doting upon everyone. He became very generous all of his money. He, you know, one of his sayings towards the end was, after all, you can't take it with you. I want to spend this on others.
Yeah.
You know, he was very generous with his employee, Bob Cratchit. You know, he saved Tiny Tim's life. Those things.
Yeah, and the one where, you know, Christmas Future or whatever shows Tiny Tim's grave, you know. So
and that stuck. You know, that's a great story, too. It hits your emotional heartstrings, and you could see it in Scrooge. He's like, oh, no. That it hurt him more than anything was seeing that a child wasn't going to make it because of his, what would I say, basically, not his frugal nature, but he just was ungiving, unyielding, and because of that, it was creating an evil. And because he had no generosity and no love in his heart, there was going to be a child that suffered because of it.
Yeah.
And an immediate child to him that he knew personally, that, oh, man, I've not been a good person. So it always makes me laugh when everybody's like, oh, you're a Scrooge. And I think, well, he was the best guy in the town after that.
Yeah, exactly.
But
yeah.
We remember the beginning of the story and that, you know, he wasn't that guy at the beginning.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, he's penny pinching and freezing his employee out and barely paying him enough. And
yeah, just not, a miser, you know.
Yeah, not giving him time off for the holiday and for his family. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, man.
Yeah.
Well, that's a good way to finish. Well, appreciate it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, thanks for having me on, as always.
Yeah, thank you. Merry Christmas, everybody. Thanks for tuning in.
Merry Christmas.